But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here with producer, good friend, and buddy, Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. It's so interesting. We do the show every weekend.
Yeah.
But I was out at the East End last week.
Really?
Just an interesting quick story, and it's funny how things come together.
Please tell me you spent like $500 at a mono while you were there.
I didn't have that opportunity, but I should have. And you'll get mad because I did dine out on the North Fork.
North Fork, yeah.
Is Riverhead considered part of the North Fork?
Well, it's kind of right. It's the crotch. It's the North Crotch.
So anyway, we were meeting family and friends, Carrie and I, out there. Carrie's sister lives out in Aquabog,
yes,
which is near Orient Point. So we were going up to Riverhead to visit her son,
right,
and return her daughter to college. Mm-hmm. So we drove out there. We had dinner at Tweed's.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You familiar with that?
Yeah, did you have buffalo?
Bison, yes.
Bison, yeah.
Yes, but I'll be honest, I couldn't really detect difference than beef.
No, it tastes very much like beef. It's
so I had a sirloin, Carrie had a filet, and I had some bison cabbage soup.
Oh, nice.
Which was very, very tasty.
Yeah.
It was a great evening. We
cabbage
were there.
Soup in a car ride is a curious choice.
What was that?
If you're eating cabbage in a car ride.
Well, that was after, so we were already out in the area. Oh, okay. So Tweed's is very, very nice, very small, very quaint. Yeah.
It's all about the decor. It's
the decor
cold.
It's all like Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And believe it or not, a Friday night it was packed. They had some sort of private a dinner before, and so we went in around 7:30 or whatever. But it was really, really nice. It's funny. The Dunkin' Donuts had a special promotion day. It was called Dunkin' Proposal Day.
Did you go for dessert or what?
And they provide, if you bought a certain amount of donuts, a ring box.
Uh-huh.
But the ring box was crafted to hold a munchkin.
Oh, really?
And they had a special limited edition munchkin in there. So when they brought the drinks, I stood up and said, instead of a toast, I have a vow to make. I carefully noted not to say proposal.
No, carefully.
But I vowed to sprinkle joy and happiness in Carrie's life.
Oh, good for
eternally.
You.
Eternally.
Yeah, good for you. All right. How'd she take it?
After she realized I wasn't putting her on the spot, she was a little relaxed.
All right, good. That's good.
So, so we started out in Riverhead at Tweed's, which was really cool. Stayed out in Aquabog and then jumped on the ferry to go up to Rhode Island, which you actually go up to New London, right?
Yeah.
So I guess Orient Point is about 40-minute ride from Aquabog.
Yeah. Half
and hour, but there is a thread going through here. But I passed Sparkling Point on the way, which I wasn't familiar where it was.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, I get to the ferry terminal. I didn't realize you can park your car there overnight for free.
Oh, yeah, sure.
They don't guarantee it will be there when you get back. But
there's not a lot of crime in Greenport or Orient.
But there is a very large parking area,
yeah,
and you can park yourself or you can actually they have like upgraded parking.
Yeah.
But this was great because Carrie's daughter was meeting us and we took one car up. Carrie was going to stay up there and I was dropped off at the ferry on Sunday and came back. My car was there, and life was real easy.
Nice. You see, I had a catalytic converter and everything, right? I mean, it wasn't taken. Nothing was...
No, everything was there.
Yeah, not a lot of crime in Orient, you know? The criminals never make their way out there for some reason.
But I have to make the comment, there's a lot of dining going on the ferry. They have a snack bar.
Oh, yeah.
Anything from soup, croissants, to baked goods, whatever. But there was a line the whole hour and 20 minutes that the ferry was traveling.
Well, people eat out of boredom, I think, you know. I love taking the ferry, and you know, it doesn't really save me, because I go to Boston pretty frequently, right? It doesn't really save me any time, but it's just that relaxing hour and a half that you have that you don't have to drive and worry about, you know, people on the highway and whatever.
Yes, absolutely. To be able to, it took an hour to get from Merrick to Orient Point.
Sure.
To Orient Point. But the quagmire in this thing is I'm in Farmingdale. Kerry's in the Belmore Merrick area. So I had to go west to go east.
That's bad management. Can't she come east to go east?
But I had the car that we were going in, so it didn't work out too well. But all in all, it was fun. Again, we passed all the different vineyards, which was really cool. And the thread that got me to this point is Sparkling Point. Yeah. We've had them as a guest.
Yes.
I definitely wasn't familiar where they were located, except they were on the North Fork. And my understanding is they have Carnival and some other interesting events.
Yeah, yeah. They're big Brazilian holiday people. They have a home in Brazil. Tom and Cynthia are the owners. And they have a home in Brazil, and they go down there pretty frequently. And they got really involved in the Carnival thing, and they brought back costumes and stuff, and they dance around.
And what time of year is that?
You know, I'm not familiar. I don't know. Not sure. But I know they're really into it, and he's got a whole get-up that he puts on, and it's pretty fun to watch. And the other thing, too, is, you know, Sparkling Point makes world-class sparkling wine. I tasted a sparkling wine the other day that was, $80 a bottle, that, French grower champagne, which is very good, but no better than Sparkling Point. And, it's funny. I've been doing a lot of wine tastings lately out there, or wine dinners, I should say. I did one last Thursday for Bedell at South Hole Social, and then I did one Saturday at Pominock. I'm doing another one this Thursday. So anyway, it's been a bunch of them, and I was saying to the people there, I was in Napa, California, out, I guess it was in January, and I tasted some really good wine out there, but I didn't taste anything any better than some of the better wines I've had here. And I'm not saying one's better than the other or whatever, but they're all on the same level now. I mean, it's amazing to me what Long Island has produced, in the last 10 years.
What was that amazing bottle they brought with them?
Cynthia's Cuvée. Cynthia's Cuvée. That's a sparkling wine made from Pinot Noir.
It was incredible.
Yeah, it was great.
Lasting memories. But, just in general, I guess Korbel is a rather
inexpensive,
lower-end champagne, which means it's from France.
Yeah. No, but Korbel is not from France. Korbel is from California.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they can't call themselves champagne? Or
no, technically they can't, but,
So you've said this before, but we seem to tend to drink sparkling wines on festive occasions without giving too much thought beyond the tickle in the celebration.
Yeah, I don't know how that all happened. I guess it's because, the one monk said, Dom Perignon said, I'm drinking the stars, whatever. And I guess maybe it's the wedding thing that, kind of lent that thought to everybody about how it's this celebratory wine, which is great. I mean, celebrate with champagne. But, I celebrate the fact that I'm still alive on a Tuesday, It's an event in my life.
So I'm perplexed. This is very and interesting that it was a French monk, Dom Perignon.
Dom Perignon, yeah.
Wow.
It was an accident. It went through a double fermentation. So anyway, listen, I drink my share of wine, as everybody knows, probably more than the average bear and more than I should. But the bottom line is I love the sport and I think it's great. And sparkling wine to me is the universe's gift to the world. I mean, it's just fabulous when it's done right. And, the shame of it is there's a couple of, kind of names out there that have cornered the market, like Veuve Clicquot and Dom Perignon and, Krug and Bollinger or whatever. And they're all good. I'm not saying they're not. But there's a lot of little grower champagnes, little guys that are, working the vineyards really hard out there that are producing spectacular wine. And if you get a chance to, and you want to, kind of investigate that, you got to go to your local really good wine shop. I mean, it's not, most of these things aren't in the average wine store. You probably have to go to a Stu Leonard's or a Total Wine, where they have a lot of wine. And tell the guy, listen, I want to just try out a little grower champagne. Pick one that you think is great, And there's three different grapes that our champagne is made with. Chardonnay, which is Blanc de Blanc. Blanc de Blanc means white from white. And then you have Blanc de Noir, which means white from red, which is, those grapes are Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. And then you have blends of all of them, But those are the three grapes. And You know, now they're making sparkling wine everywhere in the world. I mean, they make a sparkling Prosecco. They make sparkling Grunewettliner. I've had sparkling Rieslings and sparkling Chardonnays and, you know, all these other different types of wine. Sauvignon Blanc. But
have you had anything from Iron Horse?
From who? Iron Horse? Yeah. They make that wedding cuvée. There's a famous cuvée they make called Wedding Cuvée from Iron Horse.
So that's...
Yeah, I think they're in Sonoma, aren't
they? In this listing that I have in a Wine Spectator, they're the most expensive. And then Rotera.
Yeah.
Comes in. But I'm intrigued. There's something Chateau Sweet Saint Michel and Domaine Saint Michel.
Yeah, they're up in Washington.
Yeah. Are those two different vineyards or...
Domaine Saint Michel and what?
Chateau
Saint Michel. I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe two different ones.
But that's lower end, right?
Yeah. Yeah, even Iron Horse. Iron Horse is really not all that expensive when you compare it to the greats, you know, the Krugs, and, you know, they can go $500-$700 a bottle.
So just to finish off the discussion of Sparkling Point, how did they come in? First of all, the Carnival is in August. It might not technically be in August, but they celebrate it in August. Which makes sense because that's when everybody's going out to the North Fork.
Yeah, you know, we'll do it in January, you know.
But how did they all of a sudden get involved?
Well, I was kind of not involved, but I was there at the beginning, and I remember when they came to me and they said, listen, we have this idea. We're going to make only sparkling wine and building this winery. And you know, I know what wineries cost to build. It's a lot of money. And what do you think? And I'm thinking in my head, you're out of your mind. You know, why would you limit yourself? This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. And, of course, on the outside, I said, well, it sounds like a pretty cool idea, you know. Meanwhile, I'm praying for these people. I couldn't be happier to tell you that, A, I was wrong, and, B, it's the happiest wrong I've ever had because they have killed it out there. I mean, they're probably one of the busiest wineries as far as people visiting out there, you know, next to Pindar, which is, you know, Pindar is like a machine. I mean, they have millions of people visit every year. But Sparkling Point, I don't think is that far off. I mean, they kill it every year, man. They get busy. I mean, I was out there. I remember one time I was out there in the end of January. It was freezing cold, and it was a weekend. It was Saturday, and the place was packed. You know, they found a unique niche, and you know, they've exploited it. And to their credit, they hired the right people. They had Gilles Martin, who's no longer with them, but he was the winemaker there for the first, I guess, 10, 12 years. And he grew up in Champagne in France, and then he's worked for, you know, various houses over there. And then he came here. He was working for, I think, Schlumberger and a couple of places out in California. So he really knows his stuff. And he made incredible wines. I mean, the Seduction, the Brut Seduction, which is their flagship, was just as good as anything I've ever had from France, you know. And you know, to be able to stand there. And, you know, they started a trend out there because now there's a lot of people making sparkling wine. I mean, Bedell makes a sparkling wine. McCarry makes a sparkling wine. I had Pominock's. I did a dinner for Pominock last week, last Saturday at the vineyard. It was showcasing their 95 vintage, which was smoking good, right? So we had all these wines out of Magnum. But they started off with their champagne. And I guess it was about 3 years or 4 years old. I don't remember the vintage. But, man, I tell you what, it was really good.
And this
was
Pominock?
Pominock, yeah.
And they did a sparkling wine. Wow.
They've been making a sparkling wine for the last 5, 6, 7 years, I guess, now, you know. But it's in my humble opinion, it competes with anything I've had on the market. And the wines were spectacular. I mean, they had the 90, they were all 95s. They had the Cab de Merlot, the Cab Franc, and the Assemblage. And one was better than the other. My daughter and Val, they kind of preferred the Cab Sauve. I preferred the Assemblage, but, you know, it was apples and apples. I mean, you know, you're just comparing one fine wine to another. It just becomes nuance at that point in what you like, what your palate's telling you. But I can't be more excited for where, the Long Island wines are going, man. They're killing it out there.
So it's early in the season. I mean, technically we're in spring. Summer's coming, not too far away. On Long Island, going out to the vineyards is... become very, very, very popular.
Yeah.
So just give people that are not familiar with what a trip out to a vineyard might be all about.
Well, getting out there, you know, you have the North Fork Wine Trail, and you have three vineyards on the South Fork also. But most of the wineries are concentrated on the north side. And I guess there's about 60, 65 of them now altogether. There's a lot of winery out there. So you just have to plan it. You find a vineyard that you either like or you want to explore. And I would do like two or three in a day, provided you can behave yourself, you know, because take an Uber or whatever. That's the other way to go. But, you know, when you first get to the North Fork, the first winery you're going to come to is Pominock. That's the first one. That's in Aquabog. It's right there on Main Road. You can go in there. In the interest of full disclosure, my daughter does manage that tasting room. So if you go there and you tell
them. Are there two roads that run parallel?
It's Main Road and North Road.
Okay.
So Main Road is when you first get there and you get to Pominock. If you go in there and tell Courtney that you heard about this on Playing With Fire, she'll help you out.
But understand I'm ignorant as far as geography. So when I went out east, I took Northwell Pike, made a right and went on Soundview. And so what does that turn into?
That's North Road.
That's North Road. Okay. Yeah.
Now, on North Road, you'll find wineries. Harb's Winery is there. McCary's there on North Road. And then as you go east, you know, you'll find, I can't think of the name, Borghese. Borghese's on North Road. You go for, and Sparkling Point's on North Road also.
So North Road is south of Main.
The key word here is north, Stu.
It's north.
North Road is not south of anything. North Road is north of Maine.
Okay, so Maine is south.
They run parallel. So Maine is like, I guess, 25A, whatever it is. Anyway, so you have wineries on both of those. They're more concentrated on Main Road, you know, where you have Bedell and Pugliese and Matabella's on there. Yeah, the bunch of Bedell, all of them. Anyway, so what I would do is, if I was going to take a ride out there, I'd pick out three wineries. I do one, like, before lunch. I do one, like, at 11 o'clock. They usually open at 11 or so. I do one around 11 and then take a full, you know, kind of, you know, full tour. See if you can book yourself a full tour. And then it'll give you an idea how wine is made, this, that, and the other thing. And it's made the same in all of them, so you don't need a full tour in all of them. It kind of gets boring after a while to see the, you know, same thing in each winery. So, but I would book one full tour from 11 o'clock to, say, it probably takes an hour or so. So you get out of there at 1 o'clock and then have lunch. You can go to a place like, you know, Jamesport Winery has a great little, I think they call it the little pizza kitchen or something like that. They have great pizzas in there. Really good and good food. They have appetizers, you know, meatballs and whatever. It's kind of an Italian bent. But the pizza is stellar. It really is. It's fabulous. I would go there, you know, maybe grab a piece of pizza, taste a couple of wines, and then do one in the afternoon, like a Sparkling Point, especially because you'd get to taste some sparkling wines, and then you can have some cheese or whatever that they have out there. And each place has some food. So if you don't want to, you know, stop and have lunch somewhere, you can nibble your way through the, you know, the wineries. And then when you're done, then you have to go to one of my restaurants. I have three out there now. It used to be two, but I added one this year. So we have Amano in Matatuck. We have Allure, which is right on the water in Southold. And then we have Southold Social, which is about maybe a half a mile east of the village of Southold on the north side. And the north side of the road's on the north side, so it's not on the south side. It's on the north side. Anyway. We'd appreciate if you stopped by. If not, there's plenty of good places to eat out there, and I'm totally not offended if you go to another restaurant.
So if you go with the intent of dining at the end of the day at a restaurant, so during the day you're out there, is it best to bring your own food, or do the different
vineyards
have
things?
Most
of them won't let you do that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, most of them won't let you do that, and for good reason. First of all, they don't know what you're bringing in. You know, second of all, you know, they make money. I mean, it's a business, so... You know, they'll give you like a picnic basket kind of thing. You know, you'll get cheese and crackers. And I know, you know, there's a lot of different menus out there in the vineyards. So, you know, you can sustain yourself.
Now, there's interesting pairings with wine. Mm-hmm. You can do cheese. You can do chocolate. But if you're doing a day trip, probably cheese would pair nicer.
Yeah.
You know, a nice baguette and some cheese. So do any of the vineyards offer cheese? Have they paired themselves with a cheesemonger?
Yeah, almost all of them. You know, some of them have these single-serve things. And the interesting part about the vineyards is that, you know, when you're dealing with people who are in the wine business, they're also peripherally in the food business because you need food if you're going to be drinking wine. I mean, you don't want to do that on an empty stomach. And most of them have cheeses that are really good. A lot of them buy cheeses from our friend at the cheese shop, at the Manitouk cheese shop there, you know. And they have, it's not, you know, you're not going to get the, you know, the Cracker Barrel cheddar or, you know, the usual supermarket cheeses. You're going to get some higher end stuff, you know. And I think it's a great way to kill, you know, an hour, hour and a half. You know, you taste through a couple of, you know, I know they have flight tastings where you can taste, you know, three of the whites and three of the reds or five of the reds or five of the whites or whatever, however they do it. And it's a fun way to learn about wine, too. You know, you can go out there and you can, you know, check out different varietals and see which ones you like. I mean, because they're all different. They're all, you know, the flavor profiles are so different. Like, I found after drinking oceans of wine all these years that Sauvignon Blanc is not my favorite grape. And it's the one, it's, you know, listen, there are great Sauvignon Blancs out there, the Sancerres, you know, good ones in California and great ones on Long Island also. But it's just not for me. I mean, it's the last one I'll order when I go to a restaurant. Now, if somebody else orders it and I'm there, I'll drink it, you know. It's fine, but it's just not my favorite. There's 30 other grapes I'd rather have.
So it's funny, if I watch a romantic movie that people are in France or they're doing in California, the vineyards,
yeah,
you know, the cheese is wrapped in cloth and there's a baguette stuck in the basket.
Cloth-bound.
What was that?
They call it cloth-bound.
So how do you store cheese? Like, if I go into the cheese shop, there's a wonderful cheese shop in Rockville Center.
Uh-huh.
And there has to be inventory turns, so they, I guess, don't have to be all that concerned. But is it just lightly wrapped in saran wrap or wax? What's the best way to keep a chunk of cheese?
Yeah, the best thing is to, you know, ask them. I mean, you don't want to wrap it too tightly, but, you know, it has to be wrapped. I mean, I use wax paper and then a little bit of plastic, you know, just to keep the funk out of it, you know. But, yeah, I think the thing is, you know, I won't buy it in quantities where I have to keep it a long time. That's the key. The key is to, you know, make, you know, more trips. You know, if you watch cultures that eat fresh, right? I remember doing some work in Chinatown years ago, and you watch these little ladies in there shopping. They have all these little plastic bags, these little orange plastic bags, and they'll go get a head of bok choy and a head of broccoli or something and, you know, two oranges and a grapefruit, right? And they're back the next day. You know, my friend's mother is Korean. She does the same thing. You know, she shops for the day. She doesn't shop for the week or the month, you know. And I think that's key, you know, especially with cheese, because, you know, cheese can go sideways, you know, if you're not careful. So I think the thing is to buy less more often than, you know, stocking up and, you know, being lazy and not going to the store.
So when I was perusing through Wine Spectator, I came across an ad for Duckhorn Vineyards.
Yeah.
What type of vineyard is that known as?
Duckhorn make Chardonnay. They make really good Merlot. Duckhorn, they've been around a long time.
Is it a high-end, moderate?
It's moderate, yeah. They don't do crazy high-end wines.
And what to you is moderate?
Well, you mean price-wise? I would say that Cabernet's probably run, and a Merlot's probably run about $30, $35 a bottle. I don't buy retail often, so I'm not really sure. But, you know, as far as wholesale goes, I kind of know what they cost. So I'm figuring a, you know, 50% markup in for the stores. I believe that's kind of what most of the wine shops get. I'm not really absolutely positive about that because I've never been in a wine shop business, but I think that's what they charge, about a 50% markup.
And how important is a wine glass?
Well, there are all kinds of different shapes, you know, and all kinds of different makes. I think they're very important. You know, the average guy will tell you, what's the difference, man? You know, you get that all the time. The difference is how you perceive the nose. I mean, if you look at Burgundy glasses, they're wider at the bottom and narrow at the top because they want to concentrate the nose flavors for you. You know, Brandy glasses are different. You know, Riesling glasses tend to be a little bit higher and, you know, and taller and thinner. So there's all different, you know, there's all different kinds of thoughts on it. I mean, if you look at Riedel, which is one of the great
glass makers. That's where I was going.
Yeah. I mean, they have a whole different, you know, they'll the Burgundy Pinot Noir, you know, White Burgundy, Cabernet, Merlot. They have a whole different, and some of it's merchandising, I guess, to some degree. But I think it makes a difference, you know. If you go to finer restaurants, they'll give you a different glass for the reds and the whites, you know, and some people stop there, which is, you know, because if you're a restaurant, you can't, you're not going to have 17 different types of glasses. It's just impractical, you know. But, you know, a red and a white glass is, yeah, totally different.
So it's interesting. If you go into wine shops today, they, I guess, diversify a little bit. They have some accessories or whatever.
Yeah.
And a new trend is stemless wineware.
Yeah.
Which it's just aesthetic. It's not because it's the shape stays the same.
Yeah.
It's just.
See, I don't like them, and I'll tell you why. First of all, to me, they're harder to hold. You know, you don't have a stem to grip on. Second of all, your hand is warm. So when you hold it by the bottom, you're essentially slowly warming the wine, you know, which I think is an anathema to red wine especially and white wine, which is usually served cold, so it takes a little longer to warm it up. But the bottom line is there's a temperature, a cellar temperature thing with wine that I think should be paid attention to, because if you drink a warmer red wine, like a lot of restaurants will keep their red wines on the back of the bar, you know, and it gets the room temperature. You tend to taste more alcohol when the wine's warmer. There's a different flavor. Once you cool it down, it changes completely. You just start drinking wines at like 51, 52 degrees, you know, red wine is 53 degrees instead of 75. It's a big difference.
So what happens when a restaurant creates sin? So just like you said, the red wines are at the back of the bar or whatever. If somebody goes and puts an ice chip in it or an ice cube, does that just ruin the aesthetics of the flavor?
Well, you know, I'm one of those guys. I'm a live and let live cat. You know, I used to drink Amstel beer when I was a kid, largely because I could drink 30 of them and not have a hangover. You know, it was hangover proof. But I used to drink it on ice only because I really loved the beer cold, you know. Like really cold. And I wouldn't drink it so fast. And at the end, it would start to get warm. I didn't like it so much. So I used to put ice in it. And you have all these macho guys, oh, you put ice in your beer, dude, you know? Yeah, where do you think the alcohol is going? It's not going anywhere. It's the same thing, you know? It's just colder. And the same thing with...
colder, you know, but it might dilute the taste a little bit.
It does, you know, because ice is melting and, you know, it's watering down the thing. But... You know, I don't care. Once you buy the glass, a bottle of wine, I don't care what you do with it. It's the same thing with steaks, where these chefs freak out. I'm not cooking a steak medium well, or he put ketchup on my, you know, Wagyu. Whatever. I don't care. It's your Wagyu. You just spent $125 for a steak. Do whatever you want with it. It's yours, you know. And it's the same thing with wine. I mean, my mother was a box wine girl. And, you know, she would come to my house. Do you have any wine? Do I have any wine? You know what I mean? I got like 2,500 bottles in the cellar. I have wine. What do we want? Can you make me a spritzer? Yeah, okay. You know, or I said, why don't you try this? You know, so I'll bring up, like, she's a white wine girl, right? So I would bring up a Pellini Monrachet, right? It's something really smoking from Burgundy, right? And I pour a glass. And she goes, it's okay. Do you have any seltzer? You know, do you have any lemon juice? I'm like, you know, all right, you want a spritzer, here it comes, you know. What are you going to do?
So we talk about additives, you know, again, somebody, your mom with her different additions.
The Pellini Monrachet cocktail.
But I recently found out some people put salt into beer.
So
it's supposed to, in quotes, enhance the taste.
Well, salt does that. Salt wakes up the taste buds, and it's going to, you know, make everything taste a little different, you know. I think there's enough salt in beer, you know what I mean? You don't need any more. If you need to salt your beer, you're probably drinking the wrong brand. You know what I mean? You should probably find something that's a little more palatable. But, it's funny with people, you know... Obviously, you know, I wrote two books about people's neurosis and, you know, in restaurants and stuff. But it's amazing to me how I watch cultural differences in eating habits. And I mean, it's a fascinating study. I don't know what happens with people. I don't know if it's the way they're raised or whatever. But, you know, the way people eat is fascinating. It's the only word I can come up with. Fascinating to me. You know, some people grab a salt shaker as soon as the meal goes down. They grab a salt shaker and they're piling it on all over the place. I'm kind of guilty of that with pepper, only because I know I like more black pepper than the average guy. So if I get a like a tuna fish sandwich. I mean, I won't do it in a high-end restaurant, but if I get a tuna fish sandwich, I'm pouring a pepper on it, you know? So I think it's just, you know, I have friends who grew up in an Italian household, and, you know, it's funny with certain ethnicities, you know, the Italians, Jewish, and now Val has shown me Greek traditions and stuff are very, very ingrained and passed down from generation to generation. And I think that's great. I think that's, you know, that stuff should never be lost. Those traditions, you know, whether you come from a Jewish family, a Greek family, an Italian family, those eating traditions, that culture around the table should be passed on, hopefully, for generations to come. I think it's a shame when people lose that. But I see it more fiercely done, in my experience, with Jewish, Italian, and Greek. They're wild about their food, and it's grandma's food, and it's passed on, and the mother teaches the daughter, and the daughter hopefully teaches the granddaughter or whatever, and it goes on and on. I know my friend Louis DeMau, he would eat nothing without tomatoes on it. You know, it was like unbelievable. He was raised, his mother was from Naples, and she was a fabulous cook. And if you gave him something that didn't have red sauce on it, he would look at you like you were crazy.
So it's interesting you just said losing something. So I guess my mom has become of age.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing well. She's in the prime of her life.
Yeah.
But she decided she can't handle the festival preparation.
Well, it's a lot of work.
And this is like the first time. So Passover is actually the night of April 1st, Seder night, which is the beginning of the holiday.
Yeah, I'm doing it on the 2nd.
Is April 1st and April 2nd.
Right.
And Mom said, I can't do it. Our go-to in the past was kosher-style restaurants. The most memorable to me was Pastrami King in Merrick. So they didn't keep kosher. Again, it was kosher-style.
Right.
But that meant that they stayed open during Passover because in Jewish dietary laws, you need special plates. You have to rid the house of, they call it chumitz, which is bread crumbs and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like Ben's is kosher,
right.
So they're closed.
Yeah, yeah,
for the days of
the holiday. Yeah.
Bagel Boss, obviously, it's a bread product.
Yeah,
they're closed
done.
For the holiday.
Yeah.
But Pastrami King was open, and it's funny. I have two of my daughters that are with non-Jewish guys, and I think Jewish traditional food scares them away. Gefilte fish and chopped liver, you know. So
I'm with them on that.
So they would never come to Mom's celebrations, but my other daughter and her kids would. But at the same time, everybody would be willing to come to Pastrami King.
Sure, yeah.
And pastrami was, for non-Jewish people, seems to be a real
That's a hit.
Gourmet.
Yeah, that's a hit.
But at any rate, so Mom decided she's not going to do Passover. And in the past, it's so interesting. I was married and lived on the North Shore. And
that was south of...
east of west.
East of Eden.
But the different restaurants up there used to serve, in again, quotes, Passover Seder.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had the North Shore Steakhouse, which was in Great Neck,
Great Neck,
I guess.
Yeah.
You had the Jolly Fisherman.
Yeah, yeah.
You even had, I forget the name of the restaurant that was at Eisenhower Park in the day.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there was a restaurant that was open for lunch and dinner.
Right.
All the time. But these restaurants actually, they didn't do a so-called Seder, but it was just a family gathering, and they served the traditional food. So they would put matzah on the table. They would have gefilte fish. They would have your famous chopped liver.
Okay.
And then they would have brisket or roasted chicken. It really, it was an option.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of temples and houses of worship did that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, really lost in trying to find somewhere to go to have that so-called brisket dinner.
Well, if you want to pay, if you want to pay the initiation fee, you can come down to the club. I'd be happy to do that for you. I do a Seder every year, and you know, I'm kind of like, I'm younger than your mom, right? And I really, I look forward to doing it because I don't really get a chance to cook like that. It's, you know, there's no call for that for me, you know. But it's a pain in the ass. I got to tell you, it's not easy, you know. And you know, for me to make chopped liver is, first of all, I have to have a, you know, one of them tasting guys like the kings used to have, make sure they didn't die, you know, a digester would taste the food. I can't get liver past my teeth. It's just, and yet I can eat foie gras, which is duck liver, all day. It's the oddest thing. It's a quirky thing. But the rest of it, I love. I don't make gefilte fish for two reasons. One, I don't really know how, and two, it's easier to buy it. And the funny part about what I've noticed about gefilte fish is nobody under the age of 70 eats it. You know, I mean, it's like, so I'm kind of with your sons-in-law on that, you know.
So I have to ask you, in technique, gefilte fish is ground fish,
yeah,
to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah.
But fish is usually soft. Mm-hmm. It's like when you would make a white fish salad, yeah, or yeah, you would make a baked salmon salad. I would have to imagine that's whipped. So
they put gelatin in it.
There is gel, yeah, so that's the secret.
Yeah, it's gelatinized. You know, and the funny part about gefilte fish is the season is only about a week long, you know. I think they run on the South Shore.
they do serve they do serve, sell gefilte fish throughout the year. There, yeah, is, yeah, you know, you got the Asian, Mexican, or different sections in the supermarket. And all year long, there is a gefilte fish, as there is matzah. There's usually, you know, salted egg matzah crackers,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
sure,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But for sure, it's not the most popular thing. And
you know,
then,
the comedian in my, the little comedian that resides in my head sees like seven Orthodox Jewish guys with yarmulkes and payas on a pier somewhere in Brooklyn with fishing poles in there.
Well, tradition or wives' tales would, yeah, be that, and you just talked about it earlier about the your friend's mother going to the market on a daily basis.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
in the day, I guess when the it's not the ghetto, the Lower East Side.
Yeah, well, it was a ghetto.
They would go to the market. Yeah. They would get a live fish, put, uh-huh, it in the bathtub,
yeah,
until they were ready to prepare. And I guess they cook the fish first, and maybe then they grind it or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
whatever.
Of course.
But there's an interesting Sebastian Maniscalco, whose comedy is very much of Italian flavor, but Italian flavor, Italians and Jews are very similar.
Oh yeah, totally.
Somebody once told me
that's what makes Massapequa.
Yeah, Italians invented guilt, but Jews perfected it.
Yeah, exactly.
But he tells the story. He goes, you know, I think he might be married to a Jewish woman.
I think he is.
So
yeah,
he's invited to his in-laws for Seder, and he goes, wait a minute, I have to sit through an hour of stories before I get to eat.
Where's the bread?
He goes, Italians, you sit down, there's bread and butter, yeah, there's appetizer, you get right into it.
Yeah. You know, the first time I ever ate in a traditional Italian household, and my mother was English. Now, England's come a long way with food, but, you know, back in the 50s, you know, English cuisine was a book you'd never find in the bookstore, right? So I go to Louis de Mao's house, and his mother was 4'11", you know, black dress, bun, the whole thing. I mean, she was the quintessential Italian mama back then, the nana, you know. And so we're sitting there at the table downstairs. You know, the kitchen upstairs was used for, you know, display, right? Downstairs, it was a kitchen in the basement, and they had a table down there with a TV, right? So they put the football game on or whatever it was. So she comes out with lasagna. I'm probably 10 years old, you know. So she comes out with lasagna, and this is something my mother would never even attempt, right? And I'm tasting this, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. You know, would you like a little more? I'd like a ton more, you know what I mean? Anyway, I'm eating this stuff. I had no idea that was like an hors d'oeuvre, you know. There's 17 other courses coming. Veal coming, and chicken comes out. Then she's got beef, them, and that pasta thing. I'm like, oh, my God. We watched the first football game end-to-end, and then we were three-quarters of the way through the second one when they come out with fruit, and he's got me, at 10 years old, dipping like cantaloupe in homemade wine. You know, it was, the whole thing was an experience I'll never forget.
Wait, what's that all about?
And I felt like I swallowed a small farm animal on the way home. You know, I'm walking back to my house. I'm like, oh my God. Do you know, see dogs when they're dragging their belly? You know, after they had too much food. Same way. I'm like, oh my God. It was one of the experiences in my life, the food experiences in my life that kind of cemented my future, I think, you know. My grandmother was a good cook, and we always had good meals with her. But, you know, this was an Italian thing I had never really experienced. You know, my mother would make, you know, spaghetti with tomato sauce or whatever, but, you know, nothing like that. That was great.
So that thing about being stuffed, I had a situation the other day. I was invited to a business luncheon over at Old Mandarin. I talk about that restaurant a lot. It's the Asian restaurant that's the corner of Wan Tor Parkway and Old Country Road in Hicksville. Incredible. But I had a fairly nice lunch there. Yeah. Left very satisfied. But I had a political dinner that night at Hendrick's Tavern, which normally is a sit-down dinner.
Was
so
eating and arguing?
Almost. So I go to my son. I had to talk to him during the day about something, and I said, you know, usually there's a filet or a strip sirloin or whatever. Which would you prefer? Because I said, I usually fill myself up on the appetizers as it is. But this time it was a buffet. So there went my son's dinner because you can't take home buffet.
No, it's tacky.
But again, I was pretty well fed for lunch. And then I get there and they have a steak station that had French fries. It had, I guess, cream spinach, some nice steak that they sliced as requested. There was another sushi station, and then there was a pasta station.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how do I control myself? And at the same time, they're serving sliders and all sorts of really nice past hors d'oeuvres. Mm-hmm. It was torture because I just had to not be able to eat because I was already full.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. So listen, we got to talk a little bit quickly about Barry Manilow, right?
We do, but I have to say one thing to you. I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay.
So you made fun of my geography.
Yes.
I need to buy you a watch because last week's episode of Playing With Fire was 1 hour and 14 minutes.
Really?
They had to edit it down, and I'm not quite sure. I will be honest. I didn't listen to the final product, but that was interesting. So between you and I, we'll get lost and not know what time it is.
I can't. Well, we were probably having so much fun that it just kept going. But the other thing is, I don't know how long the songs are that we're playing. So
about 3 minutes.
That's what I think. All right.
But yes, thank you for bringing up Barry Manilow. The date is is fast approaching. Mm-hmm. It's April 13th at UBS Arena. I'm led to believe there's some tickets still available for purchase. Weekly have been giving away tickets, and next week I'll summarize everybody that's won so that we can reach out and in time get them their tickets. I love the fact that, again, people are writing in wanting to win, and the added question that we threw at them was the a restaurant that they might dine at.
Yeah.
You know, some people were going to dine in their hometown area and then mosey over to Belmont Park, where UBS Arena is. But again, Barry Manilow, April 13th at UBS Arena. If you don't win tickets, you can still purchase them at Ticketmaster.com. I'm led to believe that, you know, Barry's going through some health issues. The Long Island event will be the first show that he's returning to performing after his health issues, which is interesting because he'll be well rested, and we're going to get the performance of a lifetime for the last Long Island concert of Barry Manilow.
All right, well, let's play one of his songs, and we'll see if anybody recognizes it and writes in. Thank you.
spirit move me. Every time I'm near you, whirling like a cyclone in my mind. Sweet Melissa, angel of my lifetime, answer to all answers I can find. Baby, I love you.
Come into my arms, oh, let me know.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing with Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show, with your host, Tom Shawdell, chef, author, restaurateur, and geography teacher.
That's right, I am. I'm telling you, I'm a regular Magellan when it comes to that North Fork thing. You know? All right, so hopefully somebody will recognize that Barry Manilow tune and write in and hopefully get a pair of tickets. You know, it'd be fun to see.
And also thank you to Smokin' Al's, who continues to be a sponsor of Playing with Fire.
Love
and again, the entrees and the appetizers on the menu there are incredible.
Great.
And he's made it kind of easy because now there's combos and some interesting stuff. One thing's for sure, you don't leave hungry you go there.
Well, my advice is, I'm a St. Louis rib guy. I don't like the baby backs. I don't think there's enough on them. They're more annoying than anything else. But the St. Louis ribs are loaded with meat in there. Fall off the bone tender. Sauce is great. There's nothing not to like there.
Understand there's also a bar there. So you can actually go there and sit at the bar and eat or have a drink with your dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing better than a nice cocktail with you know, Smokin' Al's barbecue.
Yeah, man. All right, so while we're on the subject of restaurants, I got to tell you, I went to Huntington the other night, right? I was off on Saturday night, which is an unusual event for me. And I hate being off on Saturday because everybody else is. And everything I want to do is crowded. So we decided to go to 1653 for pizza over in Huntington. Great little pizza place if you've never been there. It's right across from the post office on the back of that strip from Main Street there. He does a great job there. Anyway, we go there, and there's no room. I mean, I don't have a reservation, so there's no room. I don't want to wait. So walked over to Jonathan's. I don't know if you've ever been to Jonathan's in Huntington, but it's a great little restaurant. And we walk in, and the place is mobbed. So I go to the hostess desk, and she says, "Do you have a reservation?" I said, "No, I'm just looking to sit at the bar. If there's something going to open up in the next 15 minutes or so, we'll wait." You know. So she's looking around. "Yeah, I think so, maybe." So the owner comes over. He knows who I am, right? So he comes over and says hello, and we're talking, catching up. So he goes, "Hang on, I'll get you down." I said, "Okay, thanks." You know. So as I was walking in, we came in the back door. So I was walking in to go to the front where the hostess station is. I see this little deuce, a table of two, right in the middle of everything. You know, and I'm looking, I'm saying, you know, who's going to sit there? Well, guess what? He goes, "I got a table for you." And I don't care. I'd rather, you know, I'm rather me than somebody else, because somebody else is going to be, "I don't want to sit in that." I don't care. You know what I mean? Sitting down. Anyway, we had this fun meal. We had, I ordered a bottle of Alto Mayo, which is a Grenache, a high mountain Grenache from Spain. And it's a killer red, right? And even the guy, you know, the owner came over, he said, "Oh, you know that wine?" I said, "Yeah, I just bought a bunch of it for one of the restaurants." So he says, "Yeah, it's fabulous." I said, "I know." So we had that. We had, we shared, you know, Val and I are sharers. So we had, we shared a prosciutto with figs, you know, which was nice, and some, had some, what you call it, Reggiano cheese shaved on it, which is really good. Just classic bread, great bread with a phenomenal olive oil. And then we split a pasta. We split a, I don't remember the shape of the pasta. I think it was penne, with a wild boar bolognese with sour cherries in it. And it was, and Val was going, "I don't know about the cherries." I'm like, you know, I trust Tito, the chef. He's a really talented guy. And it was fabulous, you know. We passed on dessert, but of course they sent us out, you know, a bunch of strawberries with a little bit of vanilla ice cream and some balsamic pearls on it, which was very nice of them. Just I don't know if you've been to Jonathan's, if you've eaten there or not, and I'm not only talking to Stu, I'm talking to the radio audience. You should go there. It's really a beautiful room. It's just a... you know, it's the kind of restaurant that I would love to own if I was, you know, going to have a restaurant in Huntington. That would be the one I would probably buy. I just love the way the room sets up. I love the separation of the bar and the dining area. And the only problem I find with Huntington, you know, Huntington to me, I've been offered some locations in Huntington over the years, and I always wanted to do something in Huntington, but parking is hell there. You know, you just can't get a parking spot. And Huntington always reminded me of the really beautiful girl or the really handsome guy that's a lousy boyfriend or girlfriend, you know? I mean, you put up with it because she looks so pretty or he's so virile and handsome, whatever. But at the end of the day, you just throw your hands up in the air and you leave because they suck as a partner, you know? It's the same thing with Huntington, you know? It has this little Manhattan feel, you know? You got this little, like, kind of metropolis going on there. But then after the seventh lap trying to find a parking spot, you know, you drive to Northport or you go someplace else because you're frustrated, you know? And unless you have a parking lot in Huntington, I don't know how people survive there. I don't know how they do it.
Parking can be a problem. It's interesting you say that because I love live entertainment. And in our area, two of the more popular small venues are what I'll call Westbury Music Fair and the Paramount up in Huntington.
Yeah.
And the radio station is affiliated with the Paramount up in Huntington. But I find going to Westbury just so much easier because it's north, south, east, west. It's easily accessible, yeah. And they have their own parking lot.
Totally.
The Paramount, I live in Farmingdale. I'm just south of Huntington.
You sure?
But it's all, well, you tell me. You
just
told me
north,
that.
You're just north of Huntington.
I know I live near there. So, but traveling up 110 or New York Avenue or whatever, or coming off of Jericho Turnpike or whatever, it's all local driving. It seems farther away. Geographically, it might not be, but the parking just adds to it. And again, on a nice day in the spring and summer, it's fine to walk through the village of Huntington.
Yeah.
On a cold, wintry day or a rainy day, not so much. Which just quickly brings up, like, my granddaughter was at she's 13, and she was in a play. They did Shrek Jr. last night. But they don't open up the auditorium till like right before the performance.
Yeah.
So my mom actually begged off of going because last year we had to park far away.
Yeah,
then you get staged till you can go in. It's difficult. And I was wondering, like, what happens with this entry if it's raining? Like, how would they handle it?
I know, it's tough. You know, I had a friend open a restaurant years ago in Huntington, and I went to see him. It was the middle of the winter, January, February, whatever. It was very cold out. And, you know, I did six laps around the place trying to find a parking spot. And I just gave up. I left. I mean, you know, it's like, I'm not, you know, if you're kids, you know, like the 22-year-olds, or, you know, they're all trying to boy meets girl thing, you walk anywhere, you know?
So it's interesting. So Kerry had business up in Albany last week, and a friend of mine has a restaurant called The War Room. It's Todd Shapiro and Greg Caggiano. And she said, might as well go check it out. Really great restaurant, premium burgers and sushi. But she got there. There's no parking. And then when I mentioned it to Liz, Todd's husband, I said, Kerry went, but she bailed.
Yeah.
She goes, yeah, the parking, you know. And
it's terrible. Well, we got to go park this show somewhere and get on to next week. It's time for us to say goodbye. It's time for Tom's Three Keys to Life.
Before we do so, I Easter is approaching, so hopefully we'll talk about Easter and maybe a little more Passover.
Cool. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. Writing about that Barry Manilow song, and we will see you next week.
Come on now, everybody. Get ready for a treat. It's time for stepping out for something mighty good to eat. You looking for atmosphere? Well, they got it happening here. They're doing barbecue the way it ought to be. Bring your sister, brother, significant other. Bring all your pals. There's always something smoking at Smoking Al.
Introducing Smoking Al's new fantasy platters. The whole gang can have fun feasting on each one of these enormous oversized platters, whether at home or in the dining room. Try the new Macho Nacho, the Bow Wow Wow, the Poo Poo Platter, the Caesar Pleaser, barbecue egg rolls, chicken wings, and a whole lot more. Smoking Al's Massapequa Park. For details, call 516-799-4900. And remember, there's always something smoking at Smoking Al's.
There's always something smoking at Smoking Al's. We'll